this year, for every legal crab that comes in the United States, there's probably two or three illegal crab that come in.
Pirate fishing in the Bristol Bay Red King Crab Fishery. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the governor works toward a deal to lower gas prices in Fairbanks.
I'm not willing to settle for, you know, a small part of Fairbanks getting gas and nobody else. I want to see as many people in this area get gas as soon as possible.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com.
Bristol Bay Red King crab is a major moneymaker for Alaska, and this year it's expected to bring fishermen about $60 million. Industry players say that amount could be even higher if pirate fishing weren't distorting the international market. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
The phrase international organized crime suggests a lot of things, like weapons trafficking or drug smuggling. Now, if you're involved in the seafood business, there's a chance that pirate fishing might even come to mind. Industry watchers say that more and more illegally caught king crab is showing up in the U.S., and that's hurting Alaska fisheries.
This year, for every legal crab that comes in the United States, there's probably two or three illegal crab that come in.
That's Jake Jacobson. He's the director of the Intercooperative Exchange, which represents most of the Bering Sea crab fleet. In 2011, his boats were getting more than $10 a pound for Bristol Bay Red King crab. Now, the base price is $7.25. While that number may change, it's not expected to beat last year's record high for a few reasons. For one, buyers aren't as skittish. In 2011, the quota was practically cut in half, and there was speculation that the fishery could even be closed down the road. This year, the amount fishermen can catch is about the same, at 8 million pounds, and panic has subsided. Alaska king crab is also seeing more international competition. Faced with a shrinking supply of Alaska product, American and Japanese buyers increasingly turn to Russia. While a lot of that product is being caught legally, plenty of it isn't. Here's Bill Giles, a deputy special agent in charge with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
The amount that's being imported into the United States far exceeds the quota that's being allowed to be taken out of Russian waters.
According to data compiled by seafood.com, reported king crab landings in Russia have gone up 3 million pounds over last year. Meanwhile, over 9 million pounds have been imported to the United States and Japan over the same time period. Giles says that it's hard to separate the legal crab from the contraband. A lot of it's processed through third-party countries and then effectively laundered into the market. He says that when NOAA enforcement makes busts, it's often because of help from Russian agents. Like in 2010, when the agency was able to seize a shipment of blue king crab coming into Seattle.
The agents started working on it, identified some anomalies in the import documents, and they took the information, contacted the Russian border guard, and said, do these vessels have this much quota? And they came back and told us that one vessel is supposed to have been scrapped or taken out of service. The other ones had a little bit of quota, but not nearly of what was accredited to them on the shipping documents.
While NOAA already has the authority to seize contraband fish, Alaska's Senate delegation is making a push to tighten pirate fishing rules. Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski have co-sponsored the Pirate Fishing Elimination Act, which would ban vessels suspected of illegal fishing from entering U.S. ports. The bill made it out of committee in August. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Governor Sean Parnell says a plan for trucking North Slope natural gas to Fairbanks is moving in the right direction. On Monday and Tuesday, the governor met in Fairbanks with a range of players seeking state money for the gas project. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Governor Parnell talked with representatives from local government, the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, Fairbanks Natural Gas, Golden Valley Electric, and Flint Hills Refinery. The governor says all entities are striving to get the same thing, lower cost energy for Fairbanks.
my meetings have driven parties to talk more together, and I see greater alignment developing. Still not there yet, but I think we've made some progress, and we will in the months to come.
Governor Parnell says the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly's recent decision to form a municipal gas utility can fit into his vision of a project.
I want to make sure that we utilize private sector mechanisms as much as possible, but I do remain open to a private and public sector commercial structure where achieving the goal of gas for Fairbanks area requires it.
Parnell anticipates it'll take a mix of state grants and low-interest loans to forward a project that provides sufficiently low-cost gas. The biggest components in the project are a $150 million gas liquefaction plant on the North Slope and a distribution piping network around Fairbanks. He says a municipal utility can be a conduit for state money to forward less economically viable aspects of the project, like getting gas to lower-density population neighborhoods.
There's little interest in serving that area, which I think is exactly where the area-wide entity can spur distribution there. I'm not willing to settle for, you know, a small part of Fairbanks getting gas and nobody else. I want to see as many people in this area get gas as soon as possible.
Governor Parnell says an additional goal of getting North Slope gas to consumers beyond Fairbanks also plays into the project.
Access to gas from that liquefaction plant for all Alaskans. There are lots of people along the Richardson Highway. There are lots of people on the river systems of this state that can benefit from propane in particular.
Governor Parnell says information provided to him at this week's meetings in Fairbanks is being handed over to Alaska Energy Authority economists for analysis. He anticipates grants for the Fairbanks gas project will be considered during the upcoming legislative session, adding that low-cost state financing can come through the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Public Offices Commission has fined State Senate candidate Bob Bell $390 for violating public financial disclosure reporting law. The complaint against Bell was filed in August. It alleged that Bell had not reported some personal finances in his financial disclosure statement he made when he filed for office. The regulation Bell violated went into effect in 2011. It requires those filing for political office to disclose information about all sources of income over $1,000. One of the clients Bell did not originally disclose was British Petroleum, which paid his company more than $1 million in 2011. The fine can be appealed to Superior Court within 30 days. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the lasting effects of abuse and other traumatic childhood events.
A generation that's experienced trauma, the impact on them is that basically they have to shut down emotionally.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're curious about the rich marine and terrestrial life of the North Pacific and are looking for an educational adventure, then come to the Sitka Whale Fest on November 1st through the 4th. Hear from prominent scientists, enjoy a 5 and 10K run and a variety of fun community events and whale watching cruises. Early registration and discount information at sitkawhalefest.org. Whale Fest is a program of the Sitka Sound Science Center. This message sponsored by the Sitka Whale Fest.
There's a significant fundraising gap between the two incumbents fighting to represent a new Southeast Senate district. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld takes a look at some of the details of the District Q race. It's the first of four reports on campaign financing in the region.
Redistricting shoved Sitka's Bert Stedman and Angoon's Albert Kukesh into an incumbent versus incumbent Senate race. The most recent campaign finance reports show Republican Stedman with the most money. He brought in about $31,000 since the August primary. That's about six times more than Democrat Kukesh's $5,000. Overall, Stedman leads with about $64,000 raised this and last year. That's almost twice Kukesh's $33,000. Still, Stedman says he's hoping for more.
Well, it'd be nice to to get that dollar amount up to about 80 to run a good Senate campaign. It's just expensive to travel around and advertising and stuff like that. It has a funny way of adding up.
The district includes Ketchikan, Haines, Wrangell, Sitka, Craig, and Kluckwan, plus numerous smaller communities. It's about three-quarters of Stedman's old district and one-quarter of his competitors. Kukesh continues raising funds, but unlike Stedman, he says he has what he needs.
It's really been hard to raise money, though, because of the so many people are running this year. Every House seat and every Senate seat, except for one. I've even seen Anchorage legislators coming down here for fundraisers in Juneau, so they must have dried Anchorage up pretty good.
Both are members of the state Senate's bipartisan majority, which blocked Governor Sean Parnell's plan to lower oil taxes. Neither got money from Alaska's major petroleum companies or the political action committees they fund. Stedman's campaign did attract $1,000 from top officials at Armstrong, a Colorado-based independent oil and gas company with Alaska investments. He also brought in $250 from the ConocoPhillips employee PAC, but he's not getting much help from his party.
Each senator can get up to $15,000 from the party. I've gotten $250 from the Sitka Republican Women, and that's it. I expect no party support out of Anchorage at all.
Kukesh got a little more party money, $500 from Juneau's Democratic Organization. Both candidates have raised significant amounts from unions and their PACs. Kukesh brought in about $7,000 from six state employee and teachers groups, plus two construction unions. All of Kukesh's PAC money came from labor groups. Stedman raised half as much labor money as his opponent. He got $3,600 from three construction labor groups. Five other PACs, including Saners, dentists, and hospitality businesses, raised his total to $6,600. Kukesh also brought in about $3,000 from board members and employees of the regional Native corporation Sea Alaska, where he's board president.
I got some money individuals who work for Sea Alaska, but no, they don't have a PAC, and they haven't spent any money on a PAC. And if they had a PAC, they certainly didn't spend it on me.
Meanwhile, Stedman got $500 from the president of Sitka's Native Corporation. The candidates' numbers have changed since their most recent finance reports, filed earlier this month. At that time, Stedman had spent about $31,000 and still had around $26,000 left. Kukesh had spent around $11,000, with twice that much left. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Juneau.
The lifelong effects of childhood trauma have been the subject of talks among the 350 participants in the Alaska Child Maltreatment Conference held in Anchorage this week and hosted by the Alaska Children's Alliance. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, such as abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction caused by substance abuse, for instance, or domestic violence, significantly affect adult behavior, social health, and physical health. That's according to Dr. Rob Anda of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the 1990s, he and Dr. Vincent Folletti of Kaiser Permanente surveyed 17,000 people about ACEs and about their health, and says the results show the higher the number of ACEs, the more problems later in life.
Those included behaviors that are risk factors for major illnesses, things like smoking and alcohol and drug abuse. We see social problems, difficulty maintaining relationships, keeping families together, the risk of growing up and being a victim of violence as an adult. And even things like being able to do your job, performing well on the job, being able to get to your job and show up and do the job well.
Anda says high ACEs scores are also linked to leading causes of death, such as heart disease, cancer, and diseases of the lungs, liver, and immune system. He says the people surveyed were well-educated and mostly middle class, but two-thirds of them had at least one adverse childhood experience, and 16% had four or more ACEs, indicating, he says, adversity is common and has no social or economic boundaries. Gretchen Schmelzer, Ph.D., is a licensed psychologist from Massachusetts. She says adverse childhood experiences are widespread among Alaska Natives of at least one generation.
Here in Alaska, we've seen a lot of, we've seen in the Alaska Native communities, the boarding schools. People weren't allowed to be with their parents and were abused there.
Schmelzer says people who experience childhood trauma have difficulty attaching to others and forming healthy relationships and in managing their emotions. She says those traits are passed on from generation to generation.
A lot of it is that a generation that's experienced trauma, the impact on them is that basically they have to shut down emotionally to survive the trauma, and they lose trust in relationships, and then it's very difficult to parent. And then their children grow up not knowing how to do either of those two things. And as they, those two things are what help us manage stress and help us kind of get along in the world. And as we have fewer and fewer of those skills, it becomes harder and harder to cope.
And says he's encouraged by the participation of a range of professionals in the conference, which includes social workers, law enforcement officers, counselors, teachers, nurses, and others who work with children. Dr. Ward Hurlburt, Chief Medical Officer and Public Health Director in the State Department of Health and Human Services, agrees a collaborative effort is needed. He says the state has programs to teach and support good parenting, but he says a broader change is needed.
Children are fragile, and we do them great harm when we don't place enough priority on bringing a child into this world, that this is a blessing and a new living being that is very fragile, that we need to take the responsibilities of raising that child more seriously than we do.
Hurlburt says the state is including questions about adverse childhood experiences in a behavioral risk survey planned for next year. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The National Park Service and Hoona Indian Association are planning to build a tribal house at Bartlett Cove in Glacier Bay National Park. Park Superintendent Susan Boudreau says the 3,500-square-foot structure will be the first Tlingit tribal house in the ancestral homeland of the Hoona people since advancing glaciers forced them to move more than 200 years ago.
The Hoona tribal house will be their place in the park, a physical identity in the park. And we would be providing venues for cultural events, workshops, retreats. But the major thing is bringing the Hoona people back to their homeland.
Boudreau says the tribal house will allow the Park Service to expand educational programs in Glacier Bay. The agency already partners with Native groups on programs for school kids and some of the more than 500,000 cruise ship passengers that visit the park each year. The design is based on historical accounts and photographs and will feature a gabled roof and thick plank walls carved with Native imagery. Master carvers and Hoona students have already finished the main interior wall or screen. Boudreau says it depicts the history of the four Glacier Bay clans and is currently on display at the Hoona School District's auto shop.
It is absolutely beautiful. You go into this building, it's got oil on the ground. It smells like an auto shop. And the screen takes you away from all of that and brings you right into what's so important about Glacier Bay and the clans. And it is pretty incredible.
The finished building will cost $3.2 million, with funding already set aside by the National Park Service. Construction is set to begin next summer. Officials from the Hoona Indian Association could not be reached for comment.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
There's a new exhibit of Arctic sculpture at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. APRN's Peter Granitz caught up with sculptor Abraham Rubin in the museum and talked about his goal to bring Arctic history and stories to the rest of the world.
I'm standing in the wide-open rotunda of the museum. The ceiling soars about five stories above this room, and it's got windows overlooking fall-colored trees in the U.S. Capitol less than a half a mile away. And at my feet is this smooth, carved piece of cedar, and on top of it sits what looks like carved, dried wood.
It's actually the skull of a bowhead whale.
That's Bernadette Driscoll Engelstad. She's the curator of the exhibit and explains the centerpiece display. The skull was found lodged inside an ice ridge by one of sculptor Abraham Rubin's cousins. The sculpture does not look much like a skull.
On the right-hand side is a hunter in a umiak. On the left, a woman with a child. So the two, I would say, central themes of Inuit life and survival, survival through the hunt and survival through the regeneration of life, are both shown here.
Those are two of the major themes of the exhibit that opened a few weeks ago, in time to coincide with the Inuit Studies Conference that opens today. Bernadette walks us upstairs, where later I meet the artist.
My name is Abraham Rubin. My given name as a child was Apakkah, and that is a name that was passed down in my family through our great-grandparents who were Alaskan shamans. I was born north of the settlement of Pollitook in the Canadian Western Arctic.
Rubin's great-grandparents grew up on Nelson and Nunavak Islands in the Bering Sea. They moved inward to Canada's Yukon to work with Western whalers. Rubin is Canadian, though he studied under Ron Sanungatuk at the University of Alaska Native Art Center.
This exhibition is called Arctic Journeys, Ancient Memories. It is an exhibition of my attempts to portray through stone the period of contact between the Inuit and the Viking Norse at around 1000 AD. It is the Viking Norse who left their Scandinavian homelands and the Inuit who left their homelands in Alaska in search of new hunting grounds.
Rubin says his art on display reflects a simple notion. When people cross paths,
things happen.
And that's on full display when he walks us to an eye-catching piece, a carved narwhal tusk. History is etched from bottom to top, wrapping around the ivory and chronicling the indigenous migration east across the Bering Strait and the Vikings' move west.
And that contact involved open warfare, then trade, communal hunting, and likely intermarriage, and then the back and forth of that relationship. There's mounting evidence that states that this relationship had lasted for several hundred years, from around 1000 AD to the 5th and 6th centuries.
Other pieces, like the brilliant blue and green Odin shapeshifter, show that the two peoples also shared spiritual beliefs. Odin, Rubin says, was the Norse god when the Vikings migrated.
In this here, we have Odin as an eagle, bear, raven, loon, walrus, wolverine, fox. In this sculpture, I have two ravens, because in the Odin story, Odin has, as a seeker of knowledge, two ravens as companions. One is called thought, the other is called memory.
And that complexity is something early Alaskans believed, too. Rubin says he wants museum patrons to recognize that people migrated across the polar region well before Columbus landed in the Americas. And he's hoping this exhibit, which was filled with people from several continents when we met, helps people understand that cultural exchange happens everywhere. It's on display in Washington through the end of the year. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Every small town has its share of drama. But according to author Heather Lendy, Haines may have more than its share right now. She offers her thoughts on the subject in this commentary about dealing with controversy in a small community.
When I heard that Oklahoma would be staged here on October 5th and 6th, I thought no one will rehearse during the busy final weeks of summer. Big plays are for midwinter. I was wrong. Lots of talented people put on one of the best shows ever. I'm still humming The Cowboy and the Farmer Should Be Friends. I do worry that the social climate change is not as positive when it comes to community controversy. The first wet flurries have barely landed, yet already February cabin fever type conflicts have begun. A potential mine on Mud Bay Road, new heli-ski rules, the property rights flap at Viking Cove, and the school's decision to nix an assembly by Amy Gulick, based on her book of photography and essays, Salmon in the Trees. The school board president thought the author's lessons on links between area fish and forests were too controversial for our students to learn. I was so embarrassed that I invited Amy over for dinner with a mix of lifelong, long-time, and new residents with ties to fishing, timber, art, the media, and local government. A schoolteacher came too. Over salmon and potatoes, we tried to explain the inconsistencies about this beautiful place and its equally impressive people, a community that I'm afraid I love too much sometimes. There was lots of laughter and spirited debate over the present and past controversies. Remember the hubbub about Playboy on sale at the grocery store, picketers at the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and the not-so-funny outcry over teaching tolerance of gays and lesbians at the high school. One of my devout Catholic friends calls Haines spiritual boot camp. God tests us daily to love our neighbors and forgive those who trespass against us, she says, and thinks it might be caused by something in the water. Our dinner party didn't, but we did consider that it could be the ground we stand on. A huge iron deposit ensures compasses don't point true north, and that Haines has more gravity than almost any place on the planet. No wonder we get stuck in our ways. Add to that glacial rebound, ever-shifting rivers, extreme tides, landslides, and earthquake faults, and it's clear that our town is built on a dramatic and shifting foundation that sometimes our psyche reflects. It's such a goofy theory that it makes sense. Although I'm sure several of my guests would disagree, which is exactly how it should be. I hope this season's early controversies don't last as long as last winter's snow. But if they do, my antidote will be to practice dinner table diplomacy. At the very least, by spring, the cowboys and the farmers will have shared a few good meals.
And finally tonight, a correction. In our story last night on the Chinook Salmon Symposium, we misidentified one of the scientists. The biologist who spoke about ocean survival of salmon was Dr. Kate Myers, not Dr. Katie Howard, as we stated. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Jacqueline Estes and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.